When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet, but I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. First, you probably know the bad news already. Mint has shut down. But here's the good news. There's a better alternative. Monarch Money. That's right. Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it. As a finance nerd, you would assume that I have my money game all together. Well, shocker, I didn't. Until Monarch Money. Monarch Money allowed me to easily see what is going on with my finances, help me get a better handle on my spending, budgets, and more. It's my go-to app every day, more so than my bank, because I can quickly see where I am with my budgets and spending, allowing me to invest more and spend time on things I want to do. It's my GPS for money. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. Create custom budgets, set goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now you get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/beginners. Monarch has a tool that allows you to easily import your data from Mint and keep all your tags and categories. Monarch is the most customizable budgeting app. Change the layout of your dashboard, toggle between light and dark mode, create custom budgets and notifications, set up automatic rules for transactions and notifications, and more. Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving the product. They release updates every 2 weeks and allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. In fact, Monarch Money is one of the first to bring you direct Apple Card, Apple Cash, and savings syncing with the latest iOS 17.4 update. Now you can sync your wallet directly for seamless budgeting. After trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's a top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/beginners. That's monarchmoney.com/beginners for your extended 30-day free trial.
What's the best way to get started in the market? Download Andrew's ebook for free at stockmarketpdf.com.
Love this podcast because it crushes your dreams of getting rich quick.
They actually got me into reading stats for anything.
You're tuned in to the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Led by Andrew Sather and Dave Ahern.
Step-by-step premium investing guidance for beginners.
Your path to financial freedom starts now.
Starts now.
All right, folks. Welcome to Investing for Beginners podcast. Tonight we have episode 208, and we are going to discuss some great listener questions we got recently. And so without any further ado, I will go ahead and read our first question. So I have, hi, Andrew and Dave. I've been listening to your podcast each week since I began investing in January. I've learned so much from your podcast. I have a few questions about ETFs that I'm hoping you could answer here or on an upcoming episode. Does the expense ratio of an ETF ever change, or is it locked in for each share I buy? Similarly, does the dividend yield of an ETF ever change? Thank you, Joseph. Andrew, what are your thoughts on Joseph's question?
So let's start, in case some of these are beginner just tuning in. An ETF is an exchange-traded fund. Easy for me to say.
Easy.
And it's basically a group of stocks bought into a single fund, and you can buy one share of it, and it gives you ownership of those stocks. The most common ones you'll see is like a market index ETF, lets you buy like basically the entire stock market in a basket. So when you buy an ETF, you have to pay an expense fee. So if you are, let's say you bought an ETF that bought the whole stock market, so that fund would give you whatever all those stocks value are, but they take some of it for themselves because it costs money for them to deal with paperwork, to deal with the regulation, all of the administrative costs that go with collecting a bunch of people's money and using that to buy stocks in a group in a vehicle called an ETF. That all costs money. So there's an expense ratio for that. Now, to answer Joseph's question, does that change or is it locked in? You have a long-term trend of expense ratios that have trended lower over the years. And so an example would be like a target date funds. Those have been able to lower their fees over the years because they've been able to use economies of scale as they've gotten bigger. They can spread out costs over more people, and that lowers costs for them, lowers the exchange rate, the expense ratios for everybody else. That would be the answer for that. The dividend yield also will change, and that can depend on either the dividends that are held in the ETF. Those can change as the companies raise or reduce their dividends. Also, the price of the ETF can change, which changes the yield even if the dividend stays the same. So those would be the answers to those two questions.
All right. So quick question then. So can you explain dividend yield quickly so somebody understands what that means?
Yeah. So if I'm buying, we could use a stock as an example. A stock from a company might pay a dividend. Let's say they pay $2. So if their stock's trading at $100, the yield is 2% because we're paying $100. We're getting $2 back, 2% of that every year in a dividend. That's 2%. Now, if the price crashes, if it goes down to $50 a share, they're still paying the same $2 in dividends. Your yield has doubled. So now you get like a 4% dividend yield instead of 2. And so that's how the calculation works. And it basically tells you how much you're going to get from dividends every year. And that does tend to be more locked in because companies are very reluctant to stop paying the dividend or to reduce the dividend. Usually they try to maintain that dividend or they try to increase it. So if I'm buying a stock with a 3% yield, I get pretty happy myself because I figure I'm getting 3% of my investment back every year, plus however much it increases as time goes on. And so that's why, if you're looking at the long term, I get excited about dividend yields.
Yeah, I can sense the enthusiasm in your voice as well as the big smile on your face when you're talking about dividends. So that's always a kind of a dead giveaway. The interesting thing about ETFs, and one of the things that I think are intriguing about them, is there's so many different flavors out there now, and you can find just about any kind of thing. Something that I was thinking about while you were talking about dividends, is there a dividend aristocrat ETF?
I bet there is. I'd be shocked if there wasn't.
Yeah.
I know they have like dividend increaser ETFs.
Right. I'd be curious to know what the yield is on that baby. It's probably pretty nice.
Explain that real quick, what that is.
The dividend yield?
The aristocrat.
Oh, aristocrat. Sorry. Dividend aristocrats are a special group of companies that pay a growing dividend over a minimum of 25 years. And they also have to be of a certain size. They also have to be in the S&P 500. So it's a select group of companies. I believe it's around 60 companies are a part of that group now. Is that correct?
I don't follow that.
Okay.
I don't know what the numbers are.
I think it's around 60 companies. And yeah, if you're a dividend person, that is something that definitely needs to be right up your alley to investigate, because those are companies that over a course of 25 years, you got to think of all the ups and downs, the world, as well as the economy, as well as just about any sort of life circumstances I've come across. We've had wars, we've had a pandemic, you've had all kinds of market corrections, as well as the great financial crisis. Presidents come and go. Lots of ups and downs in the world, and those companies still keep chugging along and paying growing dividends. There's a special group inside of that group that are called Dividend Kings, which have paid dividends, growing dividend. That's a key, a growing dividend for over 50 years. And that is a much smaller group. I believe that's around 20 or so. And some of those companies have literally been paying dividends for many decades. Coca-Cola, Johnson & Johnson, I think American Water is the oldest one, and I think they're around 100 years they've been paying a growing dividend or something crazy like that. Those are select groups. Needless to say, when you invest in a company like that, you're pretty sure you're going to get the dividend. It's a big thing. But like Andrew was saying, as a side note, the companies are loath to give up the dividend, such that they'll go to sometimes pretty extreme measures to continue paying the dividend. And a perfect case in point of that is Exxon recently. They have been on the big time struggle bus, and they were they were taking on debt, like borrowing lots and lots of money to continue paying a dividend, because they knew that if they cut that dividend, that was really one of the only things that was keeping them afloat as far as people wanting to invest in the company. And they understood that if they ever cut that dividend, they would be in trouble, because that's where they pay 4 or 5% yield on that dividend. So it's a big dividend. But anyway, when oil prices went down, the company got on the struggle bus big time. And so there was lots of concern about that. So that's just a small example of how extreme companies will go to continue paying that dividend.
Kind of crazy that for the longest time that was considered one of the best companies, and the logic was always people are always going to have to drive. Well, apparently not.
Apparently not. Yeah. I know during all the lockdowns of last year, there were times where I probably went 2 months without buying gas, because I didn't drive my car. I didn't go anywhere. I was on lockdown because my fiance, I'm diabetic. So my fiance was like, you will not leave the house. I'm like, okay. So I didn't leave the house. So I didn't have to drive. So it's great. Cut down on my gas expense. But hey, you know, there's lots of other horrible things about that we won't even discuss. So anyway,
as long as you can connect with us on the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Let's go ahead and move on to the next question. So we have looking for easy index portfolio breakdown. What percentage, if large versus medium call versus small cap versus international value versus growth? Trying to be aggressive with very little work. Set and almost forget type. I'm 34, long-term retirement goal. So that's a great retirement goal, and I love the set it and forget it idea. That's great. Andrew, do you have any recommendations for this person?
I guess I'm more of a hands-on type, so maybe I wouldn't have the best recommendation. You might have one better than me, but it does kind of show what you can do with the ETFs we were talking about earlier, because I'm sure, for sure, you can find an ETF for each of these themes. And so just by buying those ETFs, you can quite easily set your percentages, whatever you hope those to be.
Yeah, for sure. So I'll throw this out there. So when I was working at Wells, financial advisor that I work with, one of the first things he talked to me about was setting up my 401k. And so he walked me through actually this kind of idea. And because I was wanting to be a little more aggressive, we set it a little differently than he would normally do. So the way we set it up was we did 40% large cap ETFs. We did 20% medium cap ETFs. And then we did 10% US small cap ETFs. And then we did another 10% in international ETFs. And then the balance was left over, which is, I think, around 20%. We did in a mixture of bond ETFs. And so that's the way we set it. And we used the choices we had available in Wells Fargo's menu for our 401k. And so it didn't really break down between value and growth. They may now, but at the time they didn't. But there are a plethora of different ideas that you could go. But his idea was that if you want to go more aggressive, then instead of using the traditional 60-40 split that a lot of portfolios have advocated prior to the last few years, that was a traditional mix, if you will. His recommendation, if I wanted to be more aggressive, was to definitely do more stocks than bonds, and to do a bigger portion of the portfolio in a little more riskier type things like medium to small cap and international, because they tend to have a lot more volatility to them, but they also have greater capacity for growth in the long term. So that was his recommendation. So that would be something that I think would probably be a good starting point for somebody if somebody wants to follow that kind of recipe, if you will. As far as this specific ETFs, that's not really my bag. So I wouldn't feel comfortable suggesting, hey, buy this one and buy this one and buy this one. That's not really my thing. But if you go on Google, I know you're going to find a million different recommendations of different kinds of ETFs that would fit the bill to help you get down that path for sure.
Do you buy ETFs now?
I do not. That is not something that I do. I have them in my 401k, and in the past, I had them before I rolled it over. But no, I do not individually buy ETFs. How about you?
No, I don't either. And so that's probably why it's a good idea we don't give specific tickers. But like you said, Google is your friend. I am curious how, maybe looking back now with everything that, maybe why he set the percentages the way he did. And is there something that we can glean off of that? Is it just more like just to mirror the S&P or something?
I think it was some of it he was trying to mirror the S&P. But I think some of it too was he was trying to take around... He was trying to take around 30 to 40% of it and move it more towards companies that would have more potential for more growth. The 40%, the idea behind the 40% for the large cap was that was going to be more of the stable portion of the portfolio and the one that was going to see less volatility, but it was also going to be, you know, would expect to get good returns, but it would also pay dividends. And so even if the large caps struggled a little bit, you're still going to get those consistent dividends that would help continue to grow that portion of the portfolio. But the medium to small cap and the international was where you could really see some big growth, because those were the potentials for the 10 baggers or better were in those kinds of companies, just because of the nature of mathematics and them being much smaller companies, them doubling or even 10 bagging is a greater possibility than a company like Amazon that's 2.4 trillion. It's this, that's the possibility of that doubling is so anyway, that was his idea. And his recommendation was that he felt like that would give me enough growth to make me feel like I was being aggressive, but still give me a margin of safety with the combination of the large cap and some of the bond exposure, that it wouldn't be super volatile and it wouldn't be pushing all your chips in on companies from Russia kind of thing or something like that. So it still would give you maybe some exposure to some of that kind of thing if that's really what you wanted to be more aggressive, but it would also still make sure that you just, you know, you weren't going to ride the ride the roller coaster of stuff. And looking at my ETF was not something I looked at on a regular basis. I basically just checked it every quarter, and I would rebalance it every 6 months or so. I would set it to automatically adjust back to the proportions that I had set, so that it would do that for me automatically. It was cool.
One of the best ways to earn more money is to start a side hustle. Part of growing your side hustle is working with the best tools to help you succeed. Shopify is here to help. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to did we just hit $1 million order stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify's easy-to-use system allows you to set up a sales page, take payments, and start putting your new ideas and products out into the world with ease. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to help support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/beginners, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/beginners now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/beginners. Let's face it. A vibrant sex life contributes significantly to your overall happiness and confidence, but sometimes your hectic schedule doesn't leave room for doctor visits. That's where Hims steps in. With their convenient and discreet online platform, you can receive treatment for erectile dysfunction from the comfort and privacy of your own home. No more waiting rooms, no more awkward conversations, just a simple, direct path to treatment that works around your life, not interrupts it. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. Hims provides access to doctor-trusted ED treatment options such as chewable hard mints, brand-name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor visits. answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance is needed. If ED is getting you down, it's time you join hundreds of thousands of trusted Hims subscribers and get treated. Start your free online visit today at Hims.com/investing. That's Hims.com/investing for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/investing. Hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription needed. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
Yeah, and I would think that if you're planning to rebalance or if you're just planning to set it and forget it, I almost think if it's truly set it and forget it, it's so much easier to just do like a market index fund, like a S&P, and then maybe a little bit international and just call it a day.
Yeah.
If you're doing the rebalancing stuff, then it makes sense to have the different categories so you can rotate from time to time. But man, if it's really set and forget it, why make it more complicated than it needs to be?
That's right. Exactly. And if you do something like that and you do the two that Andrew was suggesting, and you buy a market ETF and maybe some international to get some possible exposure to that and get a little aggressive growth kind of idea, you're still, even over the last few years, you're looking at 15-18% return just on those ideas right there. So that's nothing to sneeze at. What's easier than that? You can commit to it and put money in on a regular basis, and it works slick. So yeah, if that's really the way you want to go, and it'll work out for you too.
Yeah, I'm not sneezing.
No, me either. And the other nice thing is a lot of this is accessible now through just about any sort of brokerage that you want to use. And the other idea is that even though Andrew and I are not ETF gurus, there are lots of educational resources and as well as guidance that you can get from your brokerages that will help you maybe track down or narrow down some of the ideas if you're looking to do something like this. If you want to find the best or maybe two or three of the best market matching ETFs, go to your favorite brokerage, i.e. Fidelity, Schwab, whoever it is, and do a little research on their platform, and you'll be able to find some great ideas through them. And they'll have lots of great resources to help you learn about the dividend yields they offer, what kinds of expense ratios they have, what the minimums are to invest in some of the ETFs, how long the ETF has been around. And there's lots of great stuff that'll help you learn as much as you can about them.
Yeah. No doubt. So I'll read the last question here, but it is long.
Okay.
I got time.
Okay.
It says, Andrew, first I would just want to thank you and Dave for your help and dedication to making a podcast for new investors. I know we all are really appreciative of the content you provide us, in all caps here, for free. Love that. Even through COVID, we are right now, I feel, at a high point in the market just based off of how well the housing industry is doing. And I bought some SPY in February and I'm up like 19% or a ridiculous amount. So when the market is at a high point, so let's answer this question first, Dave. He says, so when the market is at a high point or even at the peak, do you usually still see many of these companies that are valued below their intrinsic value, or do they tend to rise with the rest of the market?
I would say that the rising tide tends to raise all boats. So I think you see less of them when everything else is up. Now, you'll still see a good portion of them, but usually those are really out of favor companies or really out of favor sectors. But yeah, the rising tide generally tends to raise all boats.
I think I would mostly agree with that. But you depends on, I guess you have to be careful because I don't think every bull market's necessarily the same. Mm-hmm. And so even if you look at 2020 and 2021, there were so many different themes between the safe work from home stocks, which turned into the reopening play stocks, which turned into whatever the heck 2021 has been. And yeah, I think you can always find value, but I think maybe the value that you hope for isn't always the one that you'll get. So the deals that you could have got in 2019 are not going to be the same deals that you're going to get today. So you need to change a little bit how you view them when the market is so much higher. at the same, you have to be careful because a lot of times really great companies will be more expensive and sometimes you do have to pay up for it. That said, you don't have to go start buying companies at 200 price earnings ratios. So while, yeah, it might be harder to find that value that you hope for, you can still find a way to do it, in my opinion.
Yeah, you definitely can. You need to look no further than Facebook. 6 months ago was considered, had dropped into the air quote value stock arena. And I think it was trading at a PE of around 25, 26 at the time. And you know, you look at it now and it's gone up, I don't know, 30 or 40% since that time. So, you know, it really depends on what your definition of value is, but I agree with what Andrew.
At that time, or even the time now, with the average PE for the S&P at like 35, what's a 25? I think a 25 PE looks pretty bad in 2015, but right. A 25 PE when the average market PE is at 35, mm-hmm. Something to consider.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Very good
point. Maybe before we move on, price to earnings for somebody who doesn't know what we're talking about when we say PE.
Okay. All right. So price to earnings is a ratio that you could use to give you an idea of a relative value of a company. And in essence, it's the price per share over the earnings per share. Now, the earnings per share of a company is basically the bottom line or the net income divided by the shares outstanding, which gives you an earnings per share. And typically, the way you look at it is you will divide that by the price per share that it's trading in the market. And generally, the lower the number, the cheaper the company is regarded. And the way to look at it is if you have a PE of 10, for example, then you're paying $10 for $1 of earnings of a company. And so that's the way you look at it. So when we were referring to Facebook earlier, that means we would have been paying $25 for $1 of earnings from Facebook. And if you look at a company like, I can't think of a company off the top of my head, but I was looking at a company a few days ago and their PE was around 175. So that means that we would be paying $175 for $1 of earnings for that. If you compare that to Facebook, you have to get into this comparison of whether you think company A is worth more than company B, and it becomes a whole other conversation, but it's an easy, quick, easy way to determine whether you think a company might be expensive or not.
Yeah. And I think you might've posted this on our Twitter, but you talked about how you can flip the PE and it gives you the earnings yield. Mm-hmm. So just to stay a nerd for 5 more seconds, if you were to say that Facebook, going back to paying $25 for a dollar of earnings, if Facebook paid all of their earnings in the dividend, mm-hmm. You could flip that PE of 25, 1 divided by 25, that's 4%. There you get your 4% dividend yield, right, which is the same as the earnings yield. So you can think of it that way too, where you can think of PE, you can also flip the PE. And I don't know, when I made that discovery, I know when you tweeted about it, there was some excitement about, wow, okay.
Yeah.
I remember learning that as a beginner. I was like, wow, that's what that stuff means. Because everybody throws PE around. Mm-hmm. Nobody really takes the time to describe it. So I thought that would be helpful. So anyway, answering the second part of the question here, this is from Ben. He says, I was also looking at a company, I believe it was Xerox, who had decent numbers on FinViz. So I wanted to look into their 10K report and found something very odd. I looked at the most recent 10K, which I believe is 2020, looked at the previous 5 years, and noticed that earnings and revenue they posted 3 years ago on their 2017 10K did not match what they had in their most recent 10K. I found this incredibly peculiar, and I was wondering if you knew how or why this could be. I Googled the company and found that in the early 2000s, they were caught up in a scandal where they had overstated their revenues for the past 5 years. That was a huge red flag for me, and I'm decided that there was too much risk for me, but I'm wondering if that could be that they were caught up in some scandal recently, or if there was a reasonable explanation for that.
Without diving into the particulars, I'll admit I have not read through Xerox's 10Ks, but I think this brings up an interesting question. And without looking at it, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that they get audited. So the 10Ks get it audited, and they also will go back and audit prior 10Ks, even after they've already been audited and posted. So there is a chance that something happened that the auditor caught, and it could have been an honest mistake. It also could have been that they overstated their revenues like they did prior in when they got caught. It could be, it's probably one of those two things. They either did a boo-boo, which is a mistake, or they intentionally misled people and stated them as higher than they were. There's also been accounting changes on how some revenues are accounted for now. And I honestly haven't looked back to notice if there was differences from a prior year to a current year, but some of how revenue is cataloged now has changed a little bit with companies going forward, but that doesn't mean that they won't go back and adjust their financials to represent those accounting changes. And that could be what Xerox did as well. So I don't want to throw them under the bus without doing my due diligence, but those are a couple things that you could keep an eye on. But I would agree with you, if they have a history of doing this, and especially if management wasn't changed since that period, that would be something to be like, I really got to be leery of anything like that. So what are your thoughts, Andrew?
I would agree with that. I would look for red flags over if it's a habitual thing. And then I would also look at it on the sliding scale of, are we talking about like $10 million or $10 billion? What's the scope of the change that was restated? And that tells me a lot more versus, like, it's not super uncommon to see it restated like this. Where it could be a potential red flag, I think, is the size of it. And like you said, the reputation of management, how often this happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. An easy way to try to determine that would be to look at the current 10K and do a control F search for revenue or adjustments or accounting changes or something along those lines. And that'll help you, that would help you narrow down a lot quicker specifics of maybe why some of these things happen. Because if they did make changes via accounting, or if they were caught with their hand in a cookie jar and they had to make the changes, there's going to be something in there that's going to, the SEC is going to tell you, or the auditor are going to tell you that, hey, we had to make these changes for this reason or whatever it may be. I haven't heard anything through the news about anything along those lines. I don't necessarily follow Xerox, very closely. So it's not like it could have happened and it, slipped under my radar. That's, of course, certainly possible, but those are some things that would help you maybe narrow down your search. It maybe not for Xerox, but in the future, if you're trying to go through a company's 10K, this is a trick Andrew taught me years ago. The control F is like your greatest friend because it helps you very quickly narrow down different things. And the other cool thing about it is you can use this on just about anything. I use it on earnings calls. I use it on financial reports. I use it on other articles I may read about a particular company. So if I'm looking for specific items about a particular company and I have four or five tabs pulled up, I will cycle through all the tabs using Control F to look for that particular piece of information to see what kinds of stuff I can learn through a group of things. And it helps the search a lot. I'm not saying you shouldn't read through the financials. You definitely should. But if you've already read through them and now you're trying to go back and do a little more finite narrowing down of a particular information, that's a cool little trick.
Maybe next week I can do some Excel shortcuts.
Ooh, easy killer. I don't want to get people too overheated.
All right. Keep it PG for now.
Yeah, PG for now. So that would be interesting to say the least. So do you have any other thoughts on Xerox or any?
That pretty much covers it. If you really want to go deep into the weeds, we have plenty of blog posts on the accounting and on auditing and revenue recognition even. You could search it all on our website. These are just great questions. And I want to thank Joseph and Ben for writing in and that other dude on Facebook who wrote in. These were all great. And it's great to see people picking up the material and like moving forward with it. It's very exciting, and we're happy to answer these questions for people.
Yeah, we absolutely are. We love helping you guys. We love seeing all these great questions come in. I've said this many times and I'll say it again. The quality and the depth and the intelligence that people are asking us these questions is just, astounding to me. I think back on when I started, I wouldn't have asked these intelligent of a questions. I would have been like, I didn't know. The learning you guys have done is impressive. So I applaud you for all the hard work and effort you guys are putting into this and thinking through some of these ideas. They're really great ideas, and some of them really really challenge us and stretch us to come up with what our thoughts are on helping you answer these questions. All right. And with that, I will go ahead and wrap it up. So that will be it for us tonight. So we thank you guys for, again, taking the time to write us these great questions, either through the website, through Facebook, through Twitter, however you can reach out to us. We're here to help any way that we can. So please continue to send us these great questions. Go out there and invest with a margin of safety, emphasis on the safety. Have a great week. We'll talk to y'all next week.
We hope you enjoyed this content. 7 Steps to Understanding the Stock Market shows you precisely how to break down the numbers in an engaging and readable way with real-life examples. Get access today at stockmarketpdf.com. Until next time, have a prosperous day. The information contained is for general information and educational purposes only. It is not intended for a substitute for legal, commercial, and/or financial advice from a licensed professional. Review our full disclaimer at einvestingforbeginners.com.